Please feel free to look up. Seeing your faces and your eyes will probably help keep me calm and grounded. My name is Katie Springle, and I'm powerless over this talk. For people who don't recognize the lingo, that's a spoof on 12-step programs, where you start when you speak, you give your first name and say, I'm powerless over whatever. You know, I'm an alcoholic, or I'm powerless over overeating, or whatever. And it's 12-step programs that actually brought me to Zen, and among other things. Spending the past few days preparing for this talk has just been such a gift. I'm at a turning point in my life, and in a few weeks I'll turn 60. In a few days I'll be celebrating 8 years on staff at the Zen Center, and I recently decided that it's time for me to go to the outpatient program of the RZC. And get a real job. I figure that it's about time to start making some plans for retirement. So this comes at a very good time, and it was lovely to spend the time looking at the past, which you're not supposed to be doing if you understand. It's part of your practice. First, I'd like to read something from Sheng Yin. He's a Chan master in Taiwan who is a friend of Roshi's. He wrote, "Now, no matter how great a loss is, if you fully accept it straight on, the loss will turn out to be a gain. The great affair of birth and death works in a similar way. If you neither attach to nor fear birth and death, but boldly accept their reality, then you will become a liberated person in the midst of an ocean of suffering." When I was going to college, I went home for the weekend and found in my parents' basement what looked like rifle boxes filled with rifles. They were all hammered shut. And so I went upstairs to my mom and said, what are you doing with about 100 rifles in the basement? And my mother said, oh no, dear, those couldn't be rifles. Uncle Taylor just left them there for storage. It's part of some business deal. And I said, yeah, it must be some business deal. Knowing my Uncle Taylor, I just went, oh good, he's dealing arms, he's sending arms someplace. This is really great. So I opened one of the boxes, and sure enough, they were rifles. And I said, you know, you really don't want these to be in your house. Wouldn't look good. You're probably going to get arrested. And so they called my Uncle Taylor and asked him to come over and remove them. And my Uncle Taylor, I don't even know if he's still alive, but was a very crazy, hateful guy. And he did decide to take the rifles out because I told him that he had a choice, because I'd be very happy to call the police. And so he agreed to take the rifles out and made arrangements. And then he started threatening us. And in the kitchen, my sister and I were standing in front, and my dad was behind us, and my mom was just moving around a lot as my Uncle Taylor was standing, and he seemed very large and fierce at that time, just making all these scathing things and talking about what was going to happen to us and just terrible things. And I was very scared and was really not sure if he had a gun or what was going to happen. And suddenly, he sort of reared back and said to us the worst thing he could think of. And he said, you know, you girls, you're nigger lovers. And all of a sudden, my sister and I start laughing. And both of my sister and I go, yep, Uncle Taylor, you finally got something right. That's correct. But you're still going to have to get your butt out of our house. This fearful monster had just turned into a buffoon. And so often in my life, I've found that to be true. That when I'm able to just face whatever I'm really scared of, and my crazy family was full of plenty of fearful, fearful things, it's going to be okay. When I was in college, I read a book. I was a sociology major, called Worlds of Pain. And it was a study of the white working class in California. 50 long interviews with married couples in some really cheesy tract in California. And as I was reading this, I was so amazed. Here, a social scientist was reporting on my family and revealing life secrets that I didn't know were shared by others. It was an extremely moving book, and she did interviews in separate rooms with the husbands and the wives and found these stories of how much these people loved each other but didn't know how to express it, and that the people would be totally unaware that their partner also loved them. And just stories of alienation and fear and declining wages and trying to make ends meet and trying to live a life where their kids wanted the fancy shoes from Nike and they didn't have the money for any kind of shoes, and just the life that in my neighborhood pretty much we were all going through, we were all living. My whole life seems to be, and was especially true then, a yearning for moments of wholehearted, pure action while I was feeling frozen in alienation, despair, and losing myself in escapism. I remember in high school sitting on the edge of my bed, frozen for hours, unable to get up and move to my desk to do my homework, or just say, oh, what the heck, and pull out a good novel and something to eat while I read. I remember times that were clear that that I was divided against myself. I remember my dad took us to, every spring, my dad would have spring break off, and he would take that for the family vacation, and we would go down to the ocean, and we were always hoping for action. We were hoping for a bad storm, and we'd go to the ocean because you could get cabins for really cheap, you know, when there were storms on. And he knew of some places where there were bunkers from World War II, right by these spits that went right at the mouth of the Columbia River, went out a mile into the ocean, and there were bunkers built into this earth where in World War II people were expecting that the Japanese were going to send submarines up the Columbia River, and so they were lookout watches. And there was no one around, and they weren't fenced off, and so we could go into these little cement tunnels and go through the town and then go to this sort of underground town and then look up and see the Columbia River and see the ocean. And the other thing we could do was walk out on the spit, and in the spring was when the gray whales would come in to scrape the barnacles off their bellies. And this was before whales were a fashion. They were doing it anyway. And so no one knew about this except my dad, who was really into this kind of stuff. And so we would go, and we walked out this mile-long jumble of rubble that was the spit, and walked out to the end, and there were the whales. And every so often, they were huge, and you just would see this big gray back going, and then this huge whale that would come, smack. And as I was watching this, with a sinking heart, I realized that part of me was watching the whales, and the other part of me was going, okay, now this is supposed to be like a peak experience. So like, really, got to really be into this. Got to really be into this. And I was watching this all with a divided heart. With food, I would be at a party dying to have good friends. And what I was really thinking about in a conversation was, well, let's see, I've already had some potato chips. I wonder if anyone would notice if I also had the chocolate chip cookies. And oh, and that's where my head was at. The first time that Patrick and I made love, and it was the first time for both of us, so it took us a while to figure out what the hell we were doing, I was so excruciatingly self-conscious that I was also separate from the experience. And at one point, I had to get up to go to the bathroom, and so I just took the bedclothes and wrapped them around me. And he starts laughing, going, excuse me, a little chilly, why are you covering yourself to go to the bathroom? And I said, because I don't want you to see how fat I am. And he burst out laughing and said, too late, too late. There, that basic division and always standing aside and watching myself and trying to second guess had been with me for most of my life. And it became a lifelong question. In junior high, Mr. Pearson, our history teacher, was this wonderful guy. And he had signs up all over the room. And one of the signs said, to thine own self be true. For years, I would say that to myself and have no idea how to do it. Just a sense that I wasn't there. And that question was always spinning around in my mind. I became a crisis cowboy. Whenever I was doing danger, I was calm and in the moment, and it felt great. I was a union organizer for a while, and I was at some strip mall leafleting for the union. It was the Retail Clerks Union, so I spent a lot of time in places like Walmart. And we were leafleting, and this rent-a-cop comes up and says, turn over these leaflets. And, you know, being an idiot, I said, you know, something, but basically, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not going to do that. And he goes, you're under arrest. And I said, watch me. And I kept leafleting, and he pulled a gun. And like a total, I mean, it's like absolutely crazed. I go, I'm so impressed, and I try to leaflet. Luckily, there was a more intelligent organizer with me, and he just grabbed me, starts pulling me away, and says, please excuse her, officer. She's an idiot. She doesn't know what she's talking about. Come on, we're leaving right now. We'll do whatever you say. I remained proud of that for the longest time. When I got into 12-step programs, and I realized that I used to do with danger what my mother did with alcohol, that it just calmed me down, no longer divided. I knew what was going to happen. I didn't care if I died. I just wanted to be not chopped up in a million pieces. I'm going to take a few minutes to talk about my mom and my dad and my sister, and because my mom had the craziness of my family and the sanity of my family were such a jarring mix that made Zen. I just felt right at home when I first understood some of Zen. It was good preparation for staff life, too, I might add. My mom, her mom was also an alcoholic. Neither of them ever said they were alcoholics. In fact, my mom would, her heart would break every time I would say, "Mom, I think you need help with your drinking." She would say, "How can you be so cruel? How can you be so cruel?" But when she was growing up, her father, my grandfather, was basically extremely sadistic and misogynist. And he also, I found out later, was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And in Seattle, there weren't a huge number of Ku Klux Klan members, you know, so he was an outlier. And he was a dentist, and a quite successful dentist. And he used to hurt my grandma and my mom, and do cruel, humiliating things. Like, they would take this trip to Montana, and her two brothers used to tease her, and the three of them would be laughing. And my grandfather would say, "Shut up in the back, shut up in the back." And then they would tickle her, and if she would laugh, he would pull over the car and he would say, "Get out." She would say, please, Daddy, don't make me get out." He would shove her out and very slowly start driving away. And she would start to run and say, "Please, please, please." And she'd be so scared that she would wet her pants. And she would run and run and run, and he would drive off. And then maybe an hour later, he would come back. And then she'd get in the car, and he would start beating her because she peed her pants and she stunk. He had girlfriends, and he would have them pick him up at home so that my grandma would know what was going on. His two sons, he told them, after they divorced, my grandma and grandpa divorced, he told his two sons, "If you agree to not see your mom, I'll pay your college." One said, "Sure, it's a deal." And the other said, "No." So one got to go to college, and the other put himself through college and did just fine. And the one that didn't get to college was my Uncle Taylor, who was so crazy and so much like my grandpa. One of my mom's happiest memories was when she and my grandma Kate were living together. They had moved into this funky little apartment, and they had both gotten jobs in retail sales. My mom was a telephone operator at the time. And it was Christmas, and they didn't have any money, and the heat had been turned off. And they spent the day laughing and laughing and chopping up pieces of furniture that had been very expensive, but they both hated, and burning them in the fireplace to keep warm. And they had a blast. They had friends over, and people were bringing stuff, and somebody had given them a turkey, and so they just did fine. And she said it was so lovely. The other thing, my grandpa ended up in prison, and my mom went to visit him. And I asked her why, and she said, when she was telling me this story years later, because this was before I was born, and she would said, "I would go often. It was the only time I felt safe in his presence. I was so glad to see him behind bars." And because of the Irish heritage of black humor, a lot of things that in other situations might sound tragic were actually a source of great hysterical pleasure. My mom also loved all things foreign, and we used to go to Chinatown. And she, in those days, they had two menus, one in Chinese, one in English. And the Chinese menus were quite different. And so my mother would always say, "Could we have something from the Chinese menu?" And she would talk to the guy. And then when they would bring us the meal, she would say, "Can you tell me what this is and what's in this and how did you cook it?" And every so often the cook would come out to see who this crazy lady was. and would spend time, often through a translator, trying to tell her how to cook this stuff. So then we'd go around and we'd buy the food and we'd go home and we'd learn to cook Chinese. Or we couldn't afford going to France, so we got Julia Child. we spent our free time canning, going to the public market, picking blackberries, smoking our own salmon, digging clams down in Lincoln Park. And every so often, my mother had this childish side that was wonderful. And it would be summer, and it would be dark out, and she would wake us up saying, "Girls, come down. We're going to the ocean." And we'd come down in our pajamas, and she would say, "Your bags are all packed. There's pillows in the back seat. Let's go." And the three of us would take off for the ocean, which was only 2 hours away because I was raised in Seattle. But that sort of spirit of making fun out of nothing, you know, burning the furniture to keep warm and not looking back, was a wonderful, wonderful gift. And it gave me the what I needed, and gave my sister and I both the resilience and the humor to face the darker sides of our lives. My father, when I was little, he used to take me for rides when I couldn't sleep. And he put me in the back seat. In those days, the back seat had behind it a little window, and that was the only back window. And I would sleep up there, and he would drive me around and drive me around. And I still have memories of that. And I have memories of feeling really safe with him. This was before he started hurting my sister and I. But nevertheless, he started me off on a good foot. I have one of my earliest memories was we had a coal furnace, and my dad would go down to shovel the coal into the blazing furnace. And I was small enough that I must have still had, they weren't diapers, but they were the plastic pants that you wore over when you were training. And I would scoot down on my butt partway down the stairs to watch, and I'd peek around and watch him shovel the coal. But I was too scared to go further because somehow I was afraid he was going to shovel me into the coal furnace. So it was this mixture of love and fear. I remember my mom taking us to swim in the kelp beds in Hood's Canal and going through the kelp beds, and it was a scary, fun experience. I remember driving on back roads in the Olympic Peninsula, and the point was to get lost and then see what you found and see if you could figure out your way back. And we were always looking for this ghost town called the Watto. We finally found it, and it's an inlet, and there were eagles there that would scoop up the oysters and go way up and drop the oysters, and then the oysters would smash on the rocks, and they would come going ee down, sit down and feast on the oysters. In third grade, I look back now, and this is my first little karmic sign that I was going to end up in Zen. We had wonderful public education in Seattle, wonderful. And the third grade social studies class was divided between 6 months on Norway, because in Seattle, everybody's either, except for the Irish, everybody's either Scandinavian or Asian. Norway, and we were taught the story of how children helped smuggle gold to the resistance movement by putting them in under snowmen, that the resistance movement guys would come at night with skis and get the gold. And for the Asian portion, we went to Chinatown to visit a Buddhist temple. And we also had a storybook that was set in a Japanese monastery. And it was a mystery. And I still remember the pictures, the big black and white pictures of that. And my third grade teacher was my first Zen master. She had this cane, and she was really stern. And I talked too much even then, and I was always talking out of class. And all of a sudden, bam, the cane would go down on my desk. And I'd go, "Oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. Rivers, I'm sorry." When I was very little, I was asked what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I said without a moment's hesitation, "Japanese." In high school biology, I also had a Zen teacher, Paul Carosi, my biology teacher, who I had a mad crush on, would teach us things like, He'd say, okay, so you've got an apple tree. Is the apple alive or is it dead? And we'd all furiously know we had the right answer, and they would all be contradictions, and we'd be arguing like crazy. And then he'd say, so I pick the apple. Is it alive or is it dead? I take a bite of the apple. Is it alive or is it dead? And we would just, in between classes, we'd be going, well, do you think it's alive or do you think it's dead? Well, it's clearly alive. It's clearly dead. My dad, every day after work, my dad was a bus driver, and he would fall asleep in his armchair, still in his bus driver's uniform. When he was awake, he told me that he was lazy, that he never did anything with his education. But he just looked tired to me. I didn't see him as lazy. My grandma began to live with us when my mom took a job as a telephone operator because we were having trouble financially. And she knew that I had trouble with eating too much. And so she would bake these cookies, and she would tell me that they were low calorie. And I believed her. And so I would eat like these massive amounts of applesauce raisin cookies with chocolate frosting. And then I found out when I was older, my sister said, you know what? She would just take maybe a tablespoon of sugar out of the recipe. Just going, oh no. But my grandma was an alcoholic, and so when I would open a cupboard, I often found a glass of beer. And she would tell us that her doctor told her, because she was so thin, and she was 6 feet tall and thin as a rail, that she should drink beer to help put the weight on her. But that was not why she was drinking beer. So I also learned a lot about denial from an early age. And that's been really hard to discover over time, things that should have been clear but weren't. George Orwell, the writer of some sort of scary science fiction-y stories, said, to see what is directly under your nose requires a constant struggle. And hearing that was such a help, because for me it was a constant struggle on what to do about anything, or what was true and what wasn't, and how to do no harm. I would watch my parents hurting each other and hurting themselves and be incapable of intervening. And I would watch my own hard little heart and how mean I could be to my younger sister, and didn't know how to stop not being harmful, and not, and I just had no hope, didn't know what to do. When I was in high school, I also started reading things like Dr. Martin Luther King and Profiles in Courage by Kennedy. Looking for a way to get the courage to see things correctly and to do the right thing. Perhaps the most moving, important book I read at that time in my life was the autobiography of Malcolm X, because he talks exactly about having one whole set of delusions and having to discard them, and then having another whole set of delusions and then having to discard them. And that helped me so much. I was really shaken by the deaths of people that I had looked to for leadership, and still didn't know what to do. At that time of my life, my worldview could really be summed up by this poem by Matthew Arnold. Just shows what a grim worldview I had. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy nor love nor light nor certitude nor peace nor help for pain. and we are here as on a darkling plain swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. And so, that mindset of despair and a certain amount of cynicism left me a sitting duck for the one thing that I did have faith in when I lost that. And when my husband left me for a good friend of mine, it was just the rug was thrown out from under me, and I had nothing left to rely on, nothing left to rely on. And for that and for other reasons, after about a year, I was in psychotherapy because of homicidal impulses resulting from that separation. And I was so divided from myself that at the time, I was very ashamed because I wanted to kill her, but not him. And I thought that was very, very unreasonable. That not that I wanted to kill her, but that I didn't want to kill him. So I knew there was a flaw in this plan. And so I got into therapy. And the wonderful thing about this therapy, and this is where all I can say is, this: when I look back, I have no doubt that there's karma. I walked into this clinic, and the person I was scheduled to see didn't show up, and so they gave me to this guy, who I found out later was a student of Dainin Katagiri Roshi, and was working in a program at Northwestern University, had been, that specialized in the treatment of psychotic level disorders on an outpatient basis. And so I started therapy with him, and it became a very dry, pointless, arid session. I'd come in and I wouldn't really have anything to say, and I just didn't know what to do. And this went on for a couple months. It started okay while I was in the middle of just, I couldn't stop talking. What'll I do? No, I know I'm not going to kill him, but what'll I do? And then this desert happened. And I felt just trapped. I didn't want to leave therapy because I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't say anything. So I was talking to my sister about this, and she said, "Katie, I have faith in you. I know you can find the courage to say what you need to say to this guy." And so I thought, okay, she's right. There's nothing to fear but fear itself. And with that, I sat on the couch and smoked a joint to calm me. And all of a sudden, I went completely insane. I was sitting on the couch, and there were three of us. And we were all Margaret Thatcher with rat faces. And I started to laugh. And I said, "Excuse me, but I don't think this is a good outcome for letting go of my fears. This is exactly the worst fear that I could imagine. I mean, to be Margaret Thatcher would have been my worst fear. But my second worst fear was to totally lose my mind. Because I'd seen the craziness in my family. And I couldn't afford. I was afraid I'd never come back. So what started then was a year of being the walking wounded, and a year of truly not knowing what was going on. I remember talking to my therapist, and he said, "Well, can you come right in?" And I said, "I'm not sure I remember how to use a bus." And so he said, "Okay, here's what you do, and you pay the money," and so on and so forth. And I thought I was on the bus for about a month. And I remember seeing him, and just saying, okay, what do I do now? And he'd write me a note. Okay, here's your address, and here's how you get back. And I never, in one sense, I never became truly delusional, because I knew I didn't know what was going on. And there were times when it was truly funny. I was driving a car, and all of a sudden, the windshield frosted over. And since this was August, I knew it was a hallucination. But it frosted over so much, I couldn't see out the window. So I rolled the window, and I leaned my head out, and I could see. And I started laughing, going, excuse me, this is a delusion. Why can I see there? But I parked the car, and I went to a payphone, and I called my therapist, and I said, what shall I do? And he said, lock the car. Don't drive. And I go, okay. And this kind of crazy life is how I live my life. I kept going to him and saying, am I making this up? And then I'd start to laugh, and I'd go, no, I know I'm making this up. But I mean, is this some sort of psychosomatic illness so I can get your attention? He'd go, well, let's just tell me, what's happening right now? I'd go, okay. And I was working during this time. Interestingly enough, I was working with young psychotic adults in a residential program, an experimental residential program, where the staff, with the exception of the leader, were elected by the residents. And I had won this job. I won the election over two people who were qualified for the job. No, I'm a crane mechanic. At that point, I could say my last job, I was a crane mechanic. And they're going, oh. And the poor, alarmed social worker who told me, well, congratulations, you've won the election. The fact is that they chose the right person. They chose the right person. Because what happened is, they would do something that I didn't understand, and I'd have to say, I'm sorry, I'm a crane mechanic. What do you mean by this and this and this? And by God, every so often they'd stop and tell me. There was a woman who spoke in code. And she would say, and I'd say, but I don't speak that language. Can't you tell me what you're saying? And whenever anyone would say, okay, she'd fly into a rage. And so finally I said to her, Anno, can't you please tell me why you get mad when people say okay? So she said, all right. Because when I used to ask my mother for money for drugs, she would say no, no, no. And then she would say, okay. So okay means go to hell. And I said, oh. And she said, so don't use that word anymore. And I said, okay. But because of the mistakes and because I had nothing to go on, they kind of decided to take care of me. And it was within this context that I truly lost it. And I think that's one of the reasons I thought it was like some sort of weird psychosomatic trip that I was doing. And my therapist, who I found out later really knew the ropes about psychosis, thank God, said, no, 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 it's not contagious. Don't worry. No, this is real. You really are this crazy. And I go, oh, good. By losing my mind, I learned a couple things. But one thing that I learned is that I think that Roshi Kaplow was dead wrong when he said, you can't fall out of the universe. I think you can. And I think you can be floating way out of beyond the universe. And if you're lucky, you can come on back in. But I think that Roshi Kaplow just didn't get that. Slowly over time, I did come into focus. And my therapist, who saved my life, was a key part of that. And also what was a key part of that was recognizing that other people were equally in severe suffering. And that helped me so much. That's where I really understood about samsara and about the first noble truth, although it was later that I discovered the words, the first noble truth. As soon as I was able to basically function and do anything more than walking one foot in the other, or in front of the other, all of my life, for a long time, I'd been interested in Zen. And I opened up a paper and I found that there was an introductory workshop in Chicago for Zen. And it happened to be the same introductory workshop that I give here. And so, still not too sure of whether I could master a conversation with anyone, I came. And the workshop was given by Wally, who some of you know, who was the leader in Chicago. And when he was talking about faith and doubt, he said that you needed both. And I said, he asked if there were any questions, and I said, I have plenty of doubt, but I don't have any faith. And he said, where there's doubt, there's faith. And I knew he was right. I just could feel it. I went, okay, I'll try this. But at that time in my life, it was too steep. The idea of sitting still without moving was pretty terrifying to me. And Ruth Sanders visited the center and showed me how to sit and got me fixed up with a whole bunch of special cushions because I've had back problems for years. And I bought all the cushions and then pretty much at that point dropped out of Zen for a while. And the cushions used to sit in the corner of my room, and I would walk by them with sort of anxiety and loathing, like, ooh. And my dog took a big bite out of one of the cushions, chewed on it. And I went, good girl, good girl. But eventually I came back. Trying to see what's going next. One of the things that was once I was no longer. I'm going to say one more thing about being psychotic. As things began to clear. The hallucinations that I had were increasingly benign. And the last one that I had was so clearly a comfort that I just felt warm about it. And then by then, the hallucinations faded. I came home one night after working at 7720 House, which was this residence. And there were some really scary things happening there, and I simply didn't know quite what to do about them. And I was all exhausted and tired. And I had been getting late-night calls from one of the residents there who would call me like at 2 in the morning and say, I want you to take care of my roommates. They're bothering me. I go, not as much as you're bothering me, David. We're going to talk about this tomorrow, clunk. I come home tired and exhausted, and I open the door to go up to the second floor flat where I lived. And here come down the stairs a child's version of little fuzzy animals. And it was like a Walt Disney cartoon, and they're all coming down the stairs to greet me. And I just said, yep, that's just what I need. Come on, let's go get a cup of coffee. And went back up the steps. And that was the last hallucination I had outside of Sashin, that is. Oh, well, in fact, that's what I'm going to do next, is I'm just going to talk about the first 7 days Sashin I had. Well, actually, the first 2 days Sashin, I with Roshi in Chicago. I had never had so much pain in my life. And at the end of it, I was so relieved. In fact, I was in a special room with all the newcomers where Errol was the monitor looking after us. And three of us from this beginner's room asked Roshi if we could be his students. And so we had this ceremony, and we all became students. But when the pain was over, and I was standing on the back porch of the deck, and I just so happy to be out of pain, I was grinning from ear to ear. It's like pain-free, pain-free. Roshi came out, only Sensei then. Sensei comes out and goes, "So, Katie, when are you going to do your first 7-day? And I thought, 6 months in the future, 6 months in the future. And so I said, "This is the Sheen." And he said, "Okay, fine. I'll see you then." So it came. And before this sesshin, in my true fashion, I was too nervous to sit. And so I went to my first 7-day sesshin, not having sat for more than 20 minutes in the entire week before. On day 3, I thought I was going insane. And since I'd been on Stelazine, and by that time I was training in clinical psychology, getting my doctorate in clinical psychology, I felt like I knew, yeah, I really need some Thorazine and I need it now. And I went and talked to him. And we were talking and he said, "No, I think that this is fine. I think this is an acceptable level of hallucinations. It just sounds like Makyo." And I could tell by the questions he was asking, he really knew what he was talking about. He wasn't just, you know, just saying the Buddha and I can sense the vibes, you know. he knew insanity. And so I trusted him. And then I said to him, "But you know, when you say that we need to find emptiness, I know all about emptiness. I know all about this cold vacuum without anything warm at all and filled with my own hatred and the hatred of others. I know all about that. I'm not looking for that." And he said, "Yes, but you know, that very emptiness is shot
compassion."
Now, what do I do with this here? Okay. Sorry about that, guys. No doubt. No doubt. Okay. Anyway, I knew he was telling the truth, and I finished the sesshin. Since I've only got a moment or two left, I just want to talk about the other things that brought me to Zen and kept me in Zen. And so I'll just tell you a few quick stories about my Dharma sisters and brothers who have been so helpful to me. My best friend when I was in the Chicago Zen Center was Heather Todd. And before each sesshin, before I'd leave town, I would call her and I'd say, "I knew I made a mistake leaving Methodism. You know, I'm not going to go to sesshin. This is ridiculous." And we would tease each other and we'd do that for each other. And so she said, just before... and I was talking about how scared I was of being stuck with all my crazy thoughts and so on and so forth. And she said, "Okay, well, when you go in, I just want you to remember one thing, Katie." And I said, "Yes, Heather." And she said, "These boots are made for walking, and that's just what we'll do." And I slammed down the phone, but it was too late. Days 3 through 5, my mind was going, "These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. Oh, one of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you." So when I got back, I said, "I'm sorry, Heather, but I'm gonna have to kill you." And it's been a wonderful friendship. And to me, that was support. What can I say? Take it where you get it. Another example is Lou. I don't find that Lou has the best bedside manner in the world, but I do find that Lou has saved me a number of times. And one time when I was just, I was just being a jerk, suddenly realized what a jerk I was being. I just said to him, "Oh, Lou, I'm sorry I'm such a jerk." And he turned to me and he said, "Katie, we're all jerks." And I found that deeply comforting. Another thing that he said to me, I was caught in this horrible, horrible conflict with a person who had been my best friend up until then. And the more I tried to fix it, the more horrible it got. And so I went to him and I said, "Lou, tell me, what am I doing? What am I doing that's adding to this?" And he said, "I'll think about it and I'll get back to you." And after a couple of days, he just called me over and sat me down, and I started to say, "Okay, so here's the problem." He goes, "No, don't talk, listen." And so I did. Novel idea. And what he basically said was, "Katie, you're trying to fight the pain. You can't fight the pain. You need to eat the pain. And when you do, people won't keep retaliating." And that's what happened. So I chomped on that and swallowed. And each time it flared up, I tried to just remember to just take it. Just take it. And within a year, I was reunited with my friend. Another person who remains my heart, was Donna. Donna and I, early on, developed this sitting pact. And it was her idea. And I found through the years that whenever I would just do whatever she suggested, wonderful things would happen. And she came up to me and she said, "I was thinking that we could sit together starting at 4 in the morning for the 2 weeks before the June session." And I said, "Okay." And she was much more settled in her practice. And so she would sit in the zendo, and I would sit on the deck out there with a big cup of tea, hoping that the raccoons would come and distract me, and I would face out. But we got through those 2 weeks, and we got through the next year and a half, 4 a.m. every morning. Not every morning. Sometimes we decide to skip one. And it changed my practice. And I had a big black wool shawl. And we would share that wool shawl. And it was like a teddy bear for each of us. And then when I moved to Chapin Mill and she was still here, I gave her the shawl. She was losing a lot of weight at that point. And I said, "You wear the shawl." And when she left for Mexico, she left me the shawl. So basically I wear it everywhere. It's like, nope. And it reminds me of when I went to college. I asked my mom for a shift that she used to wear around the house, and I slept in that shift for 3 years. It's like, you know, I'm a big, sophisticated person, and I do not need this, but I will take it. Donna and I used to read to each other. We used to read things that we found incomprehensible. And together, just reading them to each other, they would suddenly come alive. And we spent a long time reading Stephen Batchelor's Living with the Devil, because we both felt that we knew all about living with the devil. And that's what the book is about. And we would read it, and it would just all of a sudden be magic. And it's time for me to stop. There are so many people that have helped me see things clearly And I didn't even have time to go into the power of the 12-step program. But the nice thing is that John often brings that into his Dharma talks in ways that I find so inspiring, that there's you know, people here have heard about 12-step programs and that already. But all of these things have brought me to the path. And my gratitude, I'm even grateful for my gratitude. My gratitude for everything. There's a saying in OA, I'm a grateful compulsive overeater. And I used to just want to go, oh, spare me, when I first heard that. But it's because of the pain of not being able to stop eating. And it's because of the pain of having lost my mind. And it's because of the pain of having this crazy, crazy family and not knowing what I could do, that I came to Zen, and that all of these things together are very slowly opening my heart. And I thank you all for helping me and for putting up with me for these 8 years. Or a comment. And, or if anybody has something that about their own life to add.
I just want to thank you, Katie. We really appreciate hearing so much of your story.
Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Incredibly genuine and authentic, Katie. It's a real sharing.
Thanks.
Where do we get the CD?
Talk to me.
Why don't we stop now then?
Well, actually, I just have one thing. I knew I was going to say this even before you gave your talk. One of the things I love so much about you, Katie, is the fact that you don't hold grudges, because we've butt heads a couple times in the past, but you can just drop it so quickly, so much more quickly than I can, and it's been a real teaching tool. And what if you can talk a little bit about that? Like, how did that? Maybe not. I don't know. I mean, it's just really inspiring. So I really deeply appreciate that part of your.
I appreciate that you haven't been holding a grudge, at least so far as I know, against me either, Truman. That's really good. I think that, I mean, I used to live for my grudges. So I was organized around my grudges and my anger, because my anger protected me against my dad. And I didn't go into the details, but you don't need to know the details. Until he was dead, all I could do was hate him. But it was the 12-step programs, where one of the steps towards freedom is you have to write down every resentment you've got, and you have to realize that the resentment covers a character defect that you have to be willing to let go of. And without those 12 steps, to me, those 12 steps, I couldn't have worked my Zen program without the 12 steps. And when I threw myself into the 12-step program, suddenly my Zen practice blossomed. The 12-step programs, to me, are the heart of Zen, because people talk to each other, you know. You can listen to each other's story, and you're not supposed to judge each other's story, but of course you do. And so you're taking that person's inventory, and suddenly you realize, oops, I'm taking my own inventory. You know, so it's training wheels for Zen.
Thank